You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Orla Shinawee.
Hello, Richard.
Why the hesitation, Orla?
Because you sounded like you were going to say something else. You looked at me funny.
Orla Shinawee, and today we are joined by a special guest, national treasure, Stephen Fry.
Good morning, Richard. Good
when
morning,
Orla told me that Stephen Fry was joining us, I must admit, you look different in the flesh.
You're disappointed. You look disappointed.
No, I'm only joking. It's Steve Fry, not to be confused with Stephen Fry. Listeners outside the UK might be totally bemused at this point. Steve Fry is a co-owner of sports marketing and management agency M2 Sports. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Can I just say, Richard, you told Steve that you're going to introduce him with a little joke.
none of us laughed
at that. And I put money on it being original. And I think I've lost my money there.
Has anybody ever cracked that joke before?
Never, Richard. No, it's the first time I've heard it. You really are quite unique.
Well, anyway, thanks for joining us, Steve. You've got an interesting perspective on women's cycling, and you got in touch with us actually. I mean, we know you anyway, but you got in touch with us after the February episode where we had an interview with Tracy Gaudry about the Women's World Tour, and you had some thoughts about that, and we thought they were quite interesting. So here you are. Thanks very much. Thanks.
Absolutely, and it's M2 Sports, which is the agency that I co-own.
Early plug there.
There'll be plenty, don't worry. We obviously do quite a lot of work in cycling, but especially women's cycling is something we're actually very, very passionate about and want to see if there's a way in which we can make a difference.
We're speaking in mid-March. There have been two Women's World Tour events so far. Both have been good and lots of talking points. We'll talk about them in a moment. We'll hear in part one from Anna van der Breggen, the Olympic champion, who has made a slowish start to the year, but we expect to see her around the Ardennes Classics, and there's obviously Liège-Bastogne-Liège this year, as well as Flèche Wallonne, which she's won, I think, twice before. In part two, as I say, we'll talk a bit about the Women's World Tour and discuss some of Steve's ideas. Part three, we're doing a little bit of a family special, aren't we, Orla?
Yeah, we are.
We've been collecting interviews with women riders who are part of cycling dynasties, I suppose, because there's quite a lot of them. So we'll hear from the Backsteads, Maggie.
Mrs. Backstead.
Maggie Backstead and her daughter, Eleanor. We'll hear from, who else will we hear from? Abby May Parkinson you spoke to.
Yeah, Abby May Parkinson, the daughter of Lisa Brambani, four-time national champion in her day. And I didn't realise until I was doing my research for Abby May, actually retired at the age of 23.
Wow.
Given her palmaris.
Wow.
Yeah, she retired very young. So it's really interesting chatting to Abby May about her mum. Her dad was a sprint cyclist as well. So I had a fun chat with her.
I remember Lisa Brambani when I got into cycling.
Oh, I know, Richard. I'm going red for you.
Is there a story to tell here, Richard?
Oh, come on. This is really unfair.
You brought it up. Oh. I think Richard maybe had a poster or three of Lisa on his wall.
Oh, God. That's not true. I just said she was quite a
striking
cyclist back in the day. She was a very attractive cyclist back in the day.
And you mean her style?
I can't believe she retired so young. Moving on. We'll also hear from the Drutz sisters. Am I saying that right? Drutz.
I don't know.
I did listen to them sing it.
Don't we on this?
I didn't.
Drutz. 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 Drutz.
I didn't speak to them. Hannah Troop spoke to them. Four sisters all ride for the Sport Vlaanderen team in Belgium. And Hannah Troop caught up with them. That's a fun interview. They bounce off each other quite a lot. And they've coupled them anyway, have started the season pretty well. So look out for them. And we'll hear from them in the final part. But as I said, we'll talk about racing in part one. And my blushes are fading a little bit now sufficiently that we can move on.
It's dark in here. You're lucky. And you can't see it in the podcast. You're all right.
No. So listen, Strade Bianche was the first one. I watched it on my Eurosport player on my phone without commentary. I quite like watching races without commentary, but it would have been better if it had commentary and it'd been on TV. It was on television in some places, and Longo Borghini spoke about that afterwards. She was the winner, and it all came down to the final climb into Siena, a very steep climb, wet as well, so there was a lot of slipping wheels and so on. Longo Borghini, we remember her from the Olympic road race last year, where she was the driving force in that escape. She's always very willing, it seems, to lay it on the line. She's aggressive. I remember, you know, one of the early podcasts we did last year from the women's tour, there was a stage, this hilly stage that went through Matlock into Chesterfield, wasn't it? It finished, the really decisive stage. Longo Borghini was in the move there with Ashley Moolman and Lizzie Armitstead, as she was then, and her team, Wiggle High Five, weren't very happy about her being there because they didn't feel she had the best chance of winning and were keen for her not to work. She was very much of the opposite opinion. I spoke to Rochelle Gilmore and Longo Borghini after the stage, and they had very different views about what the correct tactic was there. But Longo Borghini's view was, if she's in the break, she's not going to sit on. Her whole that would have gone against everything that she kind of stands for when it comes to racing. She's always very willing to lay it on the line. She says that after the Olympic road race, she's even more willing to be aggressive and to really race hard. And Strade Bianche is the sort of race where that attitude, that approach can bring very positive results because it is a hard, hard race. And in the end, the strongest rider often wins. And she was clearly the strongest. Still only 25, Lisa Longo Borghini. She's been around for quite a while. But I don't know, maybe she's the rider who this year might emerge as quite a dominant force. I don't know what you think.
Just to stay with Strade Bianche a sec, it was just fantastic. And if anyone listening hasn't seen the end of it, just Google it. The last bit of the race around Siena was about the best racing you can see. Longo Borghini, as you say, very strong and starting the season very well. The way she finished that was just textbook, really, because you could see that Nivea Doma seemed to be as strong, but it was all how Longo Borghini took those corners, and she didn't let up, and you could see that Nivea Doma was maybe hesitating slightly. So Longo Borghini also timed her win to the beat of the Coldplay song that was playing at the time, which I thought was just beautifully done. Obviously planned. But yeah, I thought it was just a brilliant race. And also, she had crashed quite heavily in the gravel section early in the race. She had to borrow a teammate's bike. She didn't get on her spare bike until after the gravel and got back on it again. So that shows just how aggressively she was riding it. The Bowles Dolmans girls really tried to work together to control the race. It didn't work for Lizzie Dignan this time, finished third. And she was complaining a little bit afterwards, if complaining is not too strong a description, that other teams weren't willing to work with them. And we've talked a lot about Bowles Dolmans' dominance over the past season or two. And this is maybe the first indicator, without being too preemptive, that dominance has, you know, it's got its cracks. Because once a team becomes too victorious, other teams don't want to work with them anymore, do they? And that can sometimes be the very thing that brings them down. But yeah, it made for a really, really exciting race. Brilliant racing by Lucinda Brand as well. Unfortunate to have been overtaken in the final stretches, but brilliant race.
You couldn't have wished for a better start to the Women's World Tour than that.
Yeah, I mean, Shara Gillow and Lucinda Brand, both, they did exactly what we always want to see riders do when they bridge across to a group. Just go straight past them and you know, catch them by surprise. They'd made a huge effort, obviously, to bridge that gap because those were strong riders in the front. Longo Borghini, as you say, did the right thing. Didn't panic, knowing that the hill was coming up. You know, gambled that they were going to pay for that effort, and they did. But it was a tremendous race to watch. And then a week later, we had the Ronde van Drenthe. Is that the correct pronunciation?
I think it's Drenthe. Like with a soft E in the end, Drenthe.
Drenthe.
That's it.
There's no point asking me, to be honest.
And another pronunciation challenge for me, Amelie Didericsen. Didericsen, who we had on last month's podcast. The World Championship was a huge surprise, although we know how talented she is. But to serve up such early confirmation that she's going to be, a worthy world champion, that she's not going to suffer the so-called curse of the rainbow jersey. It suggested that as world champion, she's going to be better.
And I thought that was just wonderful to see. I mean, she's such an unassuming rider. I think that will change with the number of wins that she'll hopefully get under her belt. She hasn't even had half a dozen.
What, you think she'll become quite arrogant?
No, I think she'll just become more confident and more sure of herself. And
kind of green. She, I mean,
yeah,
almost
exactly.
She's a very endearing sort of...
Yeah.
innocence about her, I thought, when you did the interview.
She's very endearing in the way that she doesn't seem to presume that she will have the leader's role in any race. And I would like to see that change. I would like her to be able to say, you know what, we've got an incredibly strong team, but I am worthy of being supported today. And that's probably what happened at Ronde van Drenthe. Lizzie Deignan didn't race that day. Maybe that's because they decided to get behind Didriksen. And she had said that she would be happy to be to play the role of a domestique in the Rainbow Vans. Much nicer to see her winning, though. Yes, it was a great
and what a sprint. I mean, you know, she was away in a group towards the end of the race. When she pressed on the accelerator, she was it was incredibly. She won by a few lengths. It was Cavendish-esque, you know. Mm. It was just an incredible acceleration, so very impressive.
And I think with Didriksen, possibly, is it now that she has had this win, and we're talking about how many wins she can get, she hasn't even had half a dozen wins at the professional level yet, because there are so many potential leaders in that team. Last year, when she got her very late first win of the season, her teammates were saying, well, you know, actually this is what she can do, and we support her, and we don't support her enough. I think that's what's going to change this season. We'll see her being given the race captaincy an awful lot more,
which could be very interesting. Mm-hmm. Isn't it? I mean, because, you know, with so many established winners, you've got strong personalities. Yeah. As well, and one of them, a new addition this year, is Anna van der Breggen, who left Rabo, where she'd been for a few years, and moved over to further bolster the Bulls Dolmans team. She's the Olympic champion, as I've said, and one of the strongest riders in the world. And Owen Rogers caught up with her recently at the Bulls Dolmans training camp. Here she is, Anna van der Breggen.
A bit, of course, it was an important goal of the season of 2016, and it, for me, I became Olympic champion, and of course you got more busy after, and I got some different things which were also really nice but make me busy, and now I'm starting a new season with a new team, and I think so far with that there's not much change. Of course you think about it many times, but I didn't really have the time just to stop and to... Yeah, for example, we just watched the road race, I think, 1 month ago together with my boyfriend. And it was the first time I saw the road race. Mm-hmm. And I was really, if you ride on a bike, you are so focused and you are in the race only focusing on what you have to do. And when I saw the race, it was really exciting because I didn't know the group behind us was so close behind us, and I didn't do many things. So if you see it back, it was... nice, and also not nice to see, of course, the crash from Annemiek was still scary. But after the finish, now I feel really happy because I know with Annemiek it all goes well, and I am really the Olympic champion. So I could see it now together with my boyfriend, and it was a nice moment of reflection. I already was 3 years with Rabo, and I had three great years. And for me also, sometimes I like changing. I like changing people around me. I like it if there are new races. It, for me, it counts with everything. Yeah, I just like to ride the new races. Like the Amstel Gold Race is important for the Dutch cycling, especially for the women. So that's, I want to be good there. If they ride for me or not, that doesn't matter really. I haven't wear the world champion jersey yet, so yeah, of course it's a goal, and it's a different, a hard goal to win. I know that, but I will try. I will try every year, and I came close already a couple of times, so that's really motivated me to try it again. So I will.
The cycling podcast Femina is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for sponsoring the cycling podcast Femina. You can get 20% off all Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com if you enter the code TCP20 at the checkout. TCP20 at the checkout. It doesn't work in conjunction with other offers, but for most Science and Sport products, you can get 20% off, which is a fantastic bargain. And we're very grateful to Science and Sport for sponsoring the cycling podcast Femina and the cycling podcast. So we heard before the break there from Anna van der Breggen, the Olympic champion. I expect to see her come to the fore in the next few weeks, I guess, as the races become a bit hillier and harder. Interesting to hear her talking about the Olympic road race and having, you know, watched it back recently for the first time, being struck, I suppose, by how exciting it was. And it's always interesting when you speak to riders who've been involved in really exciting races that they often are oblivious to that. And you know, at the time, I remember Annemiek van Vleuten obviously had that horrendous crash, and people were fearing for her life after it. And, you know, from that lead group's perspective, it was Emma Johansson, Elisa Longoborghini, and Anna van der Breggen. They went past her in a crumpled heap, but they hadn't seen it happen, and they didn't know how dramatic it had looked. It must have been fascinating for her to re-watch the race.
I mean, Anna's an incredible rider, and to hear her recall it in that way is really interesting, because I guess it's one of the uniquenesses of the Olympic road races, obviously no radios, and therefore, and on a course like that where inevitably it was just going to break up all over the place on the final ascent up that climb, they had no idea what was going on. They had no idea who was where. So sort of almost like makes the win even more formidable.
It's like racing in the dark, to paraphrase David Miller's book, but nothing to do with that at all. But, you know, I think this is the thing, that when you're watching it on TV, you've got this perspective on it where you can see the different groups, you can see who's working, you can see whether there's a chase organised or not. You know, when riders, and when sometimes you're in a team car and there isn't great, because even when there are radios, there's often not very good, you know, information coming through about who is where and who's doing what. It's one of the underrated skills of bike racing, just that instinct that, you know, to know, you know, when, and I mentioned earlier, Longoborghini was absolutely key in ensuring that group stayed clear, and that was just a sort of racing instinct, I suppose.
And interestingly, that's even more prevalent in the women's peloton than it is in the men's peloton. Obviously, we have radios pretty much across all men's racing now. Used to be just limited to the World Tour, but now pretty much goes across every single race. Within women's racing, radios are a really new initiative. I mean, literally, probably last season was the first time they were prevalent and used in the Women's World Tour races. So it's interesting to compare women's racing versus men's racing for that reason. You do see more instinctive racing, I think, within the women's peloton, and that might be one of the reasons, because they've had to do it all their lives.
And I'd actually love to see radio stay out of women's racing. I mean, a few years ago, you remember in men's racing, they talked about taking radios away from the races. It never really happened. There were pros and cons. I think once it's been established in the peloton, it's very difficult to undo it. And I think that is what makes women's racing so lovely and so dynamic and so exciting to watch. I think it'd be a shame if we were to bring any element of control into it, whenever that's maybe the USP that women's cycling actually has.
I mean, the only thing I'd say to that, and very much with sort of like my rider's hat on, is the safety aspect of radios is really, really important.
To use the Olympic road race as a case in point, from the men's race, the woman knew that corner was dangerous. We saw crashes in that exact same point. Geraint Thomas suffered a nasty crash, and his shot at Glory was over there. Vincenzo Nibali as well. Chris Froome, I understand, actually crashed on the same corner on one of the earlier loops as well, that wasn't really caught on camera. So they knew it was coming. When I spoke to Annemiek after she'd recovered and come out of hospital, she said, "I knew that it was dangerous, and that's just part of bike racing." So I'm not sure that radios would have made a difference there, but I understand that that is the argument for it.
But already this year, we're seeing, I mentioned the inconsistent TV coverage of Strade Bianche, and there's a situation with the Tour of Flanders coming up. We could see that live last year, and while the men's race was on, we were able to watch the finish of the women's race. That is in the balance this year, I think, isn't it? The TV coverage of the Women's Tour of Flanders.
When you create something new within sport, you have a moment in time to get everything right, yeah, and that's at the start. And I always felt that the Women's World Tour was maybe rushed in a little bit. Yes, we had the World Cup, but I felt that because we had new leadership at the UCI, and women's cycling was put sort of front and centre of that manifesto, that there was a need to do something quickly rather than do it right. And that's why the Women's World Tour appeared very, very quickly, in my opinion, as virtually a rebadging exercise of what was previously the World Cup, with the addition of a few additional races. But those races weren't there because the World Tour had been created. Those races were there because innovative race organisers from around the world had seen the opportunity with women's cycling and decided that they wanted to put them on. So I would have liked to have seen a more strategic thought put into the launch of the Women's World Tour, because as I say, you get this one moment in time to get it right. And for me, I'd have liked to have seen something that was actually had a better narrative built around potentially the UCI maybe retaining some of the rights to the Women's World Tour in terms of the commercial rights, so that they could go off and sell those and potentially bring in worldwide brands, which would bring kudos to the event, like we see in the Women's Tennis Association, like we see in the LPGA Tour, as two real sort of benchmark women's sporting events. And I would also like to have seen a really clear set of guarantees put in place to the race organisers in terms of what you have to do to become a World Tour event, because it's been very inconsistent in terms of what each event has done. You so I have the privilege of going to a number of these races, and I guess there's a very wide disparity in quality of infrastructure. There's a very wide disparity in the quality of media coverage, and a very wide disparity in terms of TV coverage especially.
I mean, just on that, Steve, I've seen a couple of women's races this year which have been live streamed. Are you suggesting that they don't need broadcasters, that they can cut out the broadcasters and take ownership of the broadcasting themselves?
I think we have to be a little careful in terms of saying live streaming is the answer. It's better.
Well, no, because yeah, it's better than nothing, but the quality isn't there. But is there a middle way then between a race being shown on Eurosport or another very established channel and perhaps, you know, as you say, showing it on YouTube or something?
Well, I think you should be looking at both. So I want to see high quality TV production. We know that TV broadcasters want to broadcast women's cycling. There's been plenty of appetite for it. They're not prepared to pay for it, which is disappointing, but that's understandable at the moment based on the fact that we haven't built the audience to the scale and level that we need to, such that broadcasters will pay for the content. So what we need to get to is a position where, at the moment, the onus in terms of TV coverage is all put on the race organiser. So the Women's Tour is a great example. Yeah, they pay for the TV production, yeah, through an independent TV production company to produce those 5 1-hour highlights episodes throughout the Women's Tour, and then do a separate deal with ITV4 for them to broadcast. ITV4 are happy to broadcast. The audiences are fantastic, but not quite big enough for them to sort of warrant dipping their hand in their pocket and saying, yes, we'll pay for the production. That's a huge onus on a race organizer, on top of all the other costs that they have. Putting on pro bike races isn't cheap. And for the onus to be on them to do it, I think is wrong. And this is where I think the UCI could have helped as well. Because the UCI, yeah, if they're serious about the growth of women's cycling, and I think we're all agreed that getting this sport out there and visible is probably the single biggest thing we have to do for it to continue to grow, then why weren't the UCI using their very significant cash reserves that they have to actually part fund that? Why aren't they going to the organisers and saying, I'll tell you what, yeah, we'll contribute a percentage of TV production on the basis that you then guarantee that it happens?
If only we knew someone who worked in TV.
Well, the TV point is a very important one, because you mentioned the Women's Tour and how well organised it is, and they have put together this package and ITV4 are broadcasting it, but even they say they cannot get TV interest. So you say that TV channels want to broadcast women's cycling. That's not their experience. They can't get European channels to come on board. And they say that they've been trying year on year. I mean, that to me then, I don't know, that there are bigger problems at play. But I wanted to play devil's advocate as well on a few things that we were chatting about, Steve, before we started recording. I mean, I agree with you. I think that they rushed into this. I think that something did have to be done, though, and momentum had to be continued from Brian Cookson coming in on a ticket of, partly at least, of promoting women's cycling. And I think that the narrative provided by the Women's World Tour is actually quite a good narrative from an outsider's point of view. So for me, watching at home, following on Twitter, following the races however I can, albeit in a limited way, I do think that it's much better than the old World Cup system. We've got more racing, we've got more days of racing. It's not just one-day races. And there's more consistency with the men's calendar, which I think really helps to tap into the market that's there already. when you talk about how much better organised it could have been and should have been, and comparisons with tennis and golf, the men's side of those sports are also much, much, much better organised than men's cycling. I think the problem with the organisation of bike racing from the very top is not just a women's specific one, although the women's problems are probably exacerbated from coming from a much worse position. But when you're looking at television rights and race rights and who owns what in terms of, you know, that whole marketing pie, that's quite messy on the men's side as well.
And isn't this the point though, Orla? There's a point in time here where we can actually change that model a little bit. So we don't have to replicate the way that the sport is organised for the men, for the women, because there's less stakeholders involved, and there's the opportunity therefore actually for the governing body to take a higher degree of control, which is in effect what the UCI wrestle with the men's tour. At the moment, all the control on the men's side of the sport sits with the probably two or three race organisers. And the UCI had the opportunity here to actually get a bit of control of the women's sport and just pretty much gave it all away. So you can see now the women's side of the sport actually going down exactly the same road that the men's sport has gone. And do we really want to be in that situation? I don't think we do.
It is, compared to the men's World Tour, a very streamlined calendar without clashes and so on. You know,
There are still clashes, but the World Tour overtakes any of the other races that have been.
Yeah, of course. But you know, the World Tour is a thing that, you know, all the top riders can ride all the races if they want to, and you know the leader's jersey can be there in every race potentially. The things that cause problems and present hurdles for the UCI and men's cycling are those major race organisers that you mentioned, ASO and RCS. They make token efforts to promote women's racing, but they don't really recognise the opportunity that it represents at all. Which I think there are two arguments. One is you could say that they have a responsibility to put on women's racing, and that's what La Course feels like. It feels like a box ticking exercise. But it's a weak argument to make, to say you should do it because you just should. A far stronger argument to make is you should do it because there's a huge opportunity here and it would be good for business to grow. There's a huge opportunity to grow this market. Is there the opportunity for somebody, an organisation or, you know, somebody to come in and basically take ownership of the Women's World Tour? And that would obviously require the investment that would lead to better TV coverage and so on. Could you see that happening? Could you see the UCI being willing to hand over ownership of it to a third party?
I think the problem there, Richard, is what we're talking about is what do the UCI actually own to hand over, bar a badge called the UCI Women's World Tour. The in effect, the Women's World Tour is owned in the same way as the Men's World Tour. It's owned by the race organisers already. And I think we'll continue to see that evolve. I agree with you in terms of though where the sport potentially develops is interesting. I think I get quite frustrated when I hear lots of calls, sometimes from riders, sometimes from teams, sometimes from the media, in terms of saying we have to have a women's Tour de France. I do not see that as the answer to women cycling's problems, because the tour is the tour. And you will never, ever be able to compete against the men's Tour de France, just based on how huge it is and how it engulfs the whole men's calendar, let alone trying to put a women's event alongside it. Let's go and develop the women's side of the sport in the countries that we know are actually passionate about it, and there is a market out there to want to watch it and see it. Where do I see that? I see that being Britain, obviously. I think we've got a great market here. We get 1.7 million people watch the women's tour over the 5 days. So that tells you that people want to see standalone women's racing. I think Australia's ripe for development. I think Scandinavia is definitely ripe for development. And obviously having Amelie as world champion at the moment can only help that. Germany would be another market that I think would be very, very open to the development of women's cycling. And we maybe need to look away from France, Belgium, Spain, maybe even Italy, although it's sort of Italy probably There are certain parts of Italy that are really passionate about the women's side of the sport, and we wouldn't want to lose that.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Thank you very much indeed to our main sponsor, Rafa, for sponsoring the cycling podcast Femina. Thank you very much indeed to them. Shall we move on to families?
I think we've said enough.
Probably more. We'll get you back on at some point, Steve. Orla, you were going to sing us in for this.
We are family. I got all my sisters with me. Oh, yeah.
Stunned silence. Steve's got his head in his hand.
He's headbutting his own hand. Sorry.
Anyway, we talked about this for a while.
I thought we needed to lighten the mood. We've been a little bit...
It's a bit serious, yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit serious.
Well, let's lighten the mood immediately by hearing from the fantastic Drutz sisters. The Drutz sisters.
Drutz.
The Drutz sisters, yeah. Kelly, Jesse, Demi, and Lenny. What have I said now? What have I got wrong now, Steve?
You've got nothing wrong, Richard.
Anyway, the four of them, and they all race for the same team, Sport Vlaanderen. Hannah Troop spoke to them. It was a fun interview. Let's hear it now.
Hi, I'm Kelly Dretz. I'm 26 years old and I'm living in Wilrijk in Belgium.
I'm Lenny Dretz. I'm 19 years old. Sorry. And I live in Wilrijk.
I'm Jesse Dretz. I'm 22 years old. I'm the mother of a son, Louis. He's 1 year and a half. And I'm also from Wilrijk.
Lenny and I live together with our parents. And Jesse and Kelly live
with our boyfriends.
Okay, perfect. And so do you go out and train quite a lot together then?
We try to go ride together, and we will see it's possible because she has to go to school, and she also, Lenny and Demi. And Jesse is also sometimes far away from Antwerp because her boyfriend lives out of the city.
When we are racing together, we try to do our training together. But when the races are more separate, it's difficult to train together. But when we are all in Belgium and all at the same place, we always train together.
Do you think that kind of gives you a bit of a benefit that helps keep you motivated?
When we train together and you have to do a sprint, it's always nicer to do it next to the other girl.
It's like a little competition in the training. So
it's really better
for us and better for each other.
And also when one of the girls doesn't want to go to training or...
It's a bit tired.
You have to say, come on, let's go together, and it's nicer.
Who's the one who usually is like, I don't want to go training?
It depends.
Everyone has it. Everyone has a day when it's more like, no, I don't feel like training today. And
when it's rainy or it's dark outside.
Okay, no problem, we'll pick you up.
And so do you think there is quite a healthy competitiveness between you all?
Not really competition, but really to support each other, and
we know what's
really nice
each of us can do in the race. So
we are four different racers. She is more a climbing sprinter. She's a hard rider. I'm a sprinter, and she's also
all rounder.
Yes.
And so, when you were growing up, did you grow up in quite a cycling family? Or are you kind of the first members of the family to get into cycling?
Our uncle raced, but...
We were too young to realize it, so we didn't.
We did first gymnastics, then triathlon, and then so we came...
We follow our brother.
Yeah.
You want to race, you want to be a cyclist, and mom and dad said, no, wait, and you have to do first other sports and do something different, and... That's the reason we are doing duathlon and triathlon, and then we go over to cyclists.
Why was there a reason why they didn't want you to go into cycling for a start? Because cycling is obviously such a big sport in Belgium.
It's not cycling, but they wanted us to do more than one sport. They wanted us to see more than one thing. So with treadmill, you have swimming, running and cycling, so you have three sports, and then with cycling it's just cycling, so that's why
you have a full body cycling
development of our body for that. That's why they wanted us to do more than one sport.
Are you all full-time cyclists, or do you have other jobs as well?
They go to school.
Yeah, obviously.
She's a pro cyclist, and I am as well. She's going to be a teacher, so it's university, high school.
High school,
No, it's not high school. It's not university, but...
Allez.
Something between.
I want to get my diploma, and then... try to be a cyclist, pro cyclist, and then after that I have my diploma and I can work as a teacher. So first cycling and then teaching.
And so when you're actually in a race, so this is going to be the first race that you've all four of you raced together, but surely you've raced like one or two of you. And how do you find in the race, do you find that the bonds that you have as siblings means that you can understand better in a race together?
How does that work? Look to each other to see, and we know already
that's how she's feeling, the body language
is really
says a lot.
We know it, we know it from each other, so it's
we have the same problem.
We don't have to speak to understand each other.
Also, when you're in a race, then if you ever see each other have like a crash or anything, that surely is
it's not nice. I think every one of us does it. We look to see if it's one of our team, and when it's a sister, it's not. It's,
are they okay?
The feeling is not good. Yes. But when they come back, or when you see it's okay, then in your head you're okay. But it's not nice to see someone of your team, and especially a sister. It's not something we like.
So that was the Dretz sisters.
Got there in
Dretz.
The end.
They sound like they have fun.
Oh, that was lovely to listen to. How refreshing. I mean, what a lovely way for a family to be. You know, just to be out riding every day, to be supporting each other, to ride in the same team. I thought that was really, really lovely.
Could you imagine what it must be like for their mum and dad?
And their brother, who's also a cyclist. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, it'd be brilliant for their mum and dad. Off you go, girls.
Absolutely.
See you at tea time.
Yeah. I've been able to watch them a few times this year, actually, and don't ask me which one. But one of them was very aggressive at Het Nieuwsblad, actually.
So, right. Jesse was fifth at Le Samin, the Didam, recently, which, you know, big race in Belgium. Kelly was second on stage four of the women's stage race down in Valencia as well. So she started the season well. She's a former world champion on the track as well. And the youngest one, Lenny, who's 19, she was a Belgian junior champion two years ago on road and track. So they're decent, you know, good riders. They've got a team pursuit. Team, haven't they? Four of them. Yeah. They could compete as a family.
That would be impressive, wouldn't it, to see that representing Belgium, Tokyo 2020, the Dretz sisters.
You've got it. Make it happen.
That'd be brilliant. Yeah, imagine the posters come from far and wide to watch the Dretz sisters.
I know, speaking to Hannah Barnes in particular as well, her sister Alice, and we should have mentioned her earlier, she rode outstandingly well recently in the Ronde van Drenthe. She's very talented, but Hannah was saying when Alice was coming through and starting to compete in the same races, she was torn between, you know, looking out for her but also being concerned for her, and whenever she could hear a crash or anything happening, she'd be looking around checking it wasn't her sister. And there's obviously that element too, that you're sort of maybe not as focused on your own race as you could be, especially for the older sibling, I think.
Yeah, I'm sure that probably goes quite quickly, though, because I'm sure the younger ones prove themselves and learn their way fairly quickly.
The younger ones don't seem to care so much about that. It's always the older siblings who are more concerned for the younger one, I think.
I think there's also that whole bit of about a bit of sibling rivalry that comes in as well, that can actually be just a little bit of additional motivation. They just want to kick each other's butt, to be honest, a lot of the time.
Usually in sporting families, the younger one tends to end up better. I mean, the Schleck brothers being one example, but I can't think of many sporting families where the opposite has been... Miguel Indurain and his younger brother, Prudencio. That's a very clear example of the older brother being slightly better.
Is Juraj Sagan...
Juraj is older than Peter Sagan.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So there's another example. Orla's
I'm racking my brains now. Andy and Jamie Murray. Which one's older?
Jamie's older. Jamie's older, but I didn't know we were extending it beyond, to other sports.
He just said sport.
Okay, yep, fair enough.
Let's get back to the topic, though, eh? You moved into men's cycling, I thought let's just take it wherever
let's go on to our next, family. A family you probably know well, Steve, being based in Wales as you are, because Magnus Backstead.
Oh, my God, I can't believe... That's what people say to me. You must know her. She's from Ireland.
No, but hang on.
Wales is quite a big country.
Yeah, Wales is quite a big country, but the cycling community in Wales is not huge. Steve, do you know the Backsteads?
I don't know them at all. So we'll reverse out of that cul-de-sac.
But
you're right, Richard. The South Wales cycling community is one very, very strong. And everybody knows everybody, apart from the fact that I don't know the Backsteads.
Don't bother editing that out. We'll leave that in. It's only fair. Well, let's hear from them. Magnus Backstead, former winner, of course, of Paris-Roubaix, and a professional rider for many years. A Tour de France stage winner as well, wasn't he, at one point? And let's hear from him. His daughter is a promising young rider. Here they are, Magnus and Eleanor Backstead.
Well, we are in central London, City Hall, where we've just had the announcement of the Women's Tour route for the year. And we've got Magnus Backstead and his daughter Eleanor, both here. Thanks for joining us. And Richard.
Glad to clear up the fact that Maggie is not a promising female rider. Maggie, you don't look like a promising female rider.
No, I think I'm a bit ex now. There was a few years ago since I rode, but and definitely not a female one.
Right, this has to be put into context here, Richard. I can't believe you've done this to me. The wonderful Charlotte, who's sitting beside us, who set up for Magnus and Eleanor to come from Wales this morning, sent me a text message last night saying, I just wanted to check that we're still on for Maggie and Eleanor because they've got to get the tree in. I've been working quite a lot recently, and so I'm a little bit tired, and I read the text message, and I replied and said, yeah, that's great. I mean, I knew we were doing Eleanor, but I don't know who Maggie is. But if you think she's a good rider, I'm sure we'll find a spot for her in the podcast. And then sent a subsequent message to Richard saying, just to warn you, we've got Eleanor, but another lady, Maggie. I'm not sure who she is. I'm a bit embarrassed to ask, but I'm sure we'll find out tomorrow. To which, of course, Richard replied, do you mean Magnus? The penny dropped. I felt like an absolute... I won't say the word, expletive. And here we are. So welcome, Maggie. You're much more masculine in person than I thought you might have been.
Eleanor, you come from a cycling family, obviously. Tell us how you started cycling and then racing.
I started when I was quite little, just inspired by Dad and Mum racing. Did my first race when I was about four-ish and just loved it ever since, really.
So you never had a choice, really, did you?
No, but if I didn't like it, then I wouldn't do it.
So how did you sort of progress from there? And you know, as you got more into it, was there a particular discipline that you enjoyed more than others?
I like all disciplines, really. My club when I was younger was mainly flyers, and that's mainly road and track. So I've kind of stuck to those with a bit of cyclocross sometimes in the winter just to get training up.
Maggie, how do you obviously support and encourage without, I guess, putting pressure on? Because when, you know, your parents, obviously, your wife as well, have a great pedigree in the sport, how do you get that balance right?
Well, it can be tricky at points, obviously, and I certainly don't want to be a pushy parent. I just want to facilitate whatever both Eleanor and her younger sister Zoe want to do. If they want to keep in the sport, then that's brilliant, because, you know, it's something that both me and Meg, my wife, have enjoyed through our careers. But at the same time, like Eleanor said, if they don't want to do it, then that's fine as well. It's not a problem. So it's just finding that right balance between life and training and school and everything else around it, and just back them up with the decisions that they make. And sometimes it's a question of just putting down all the options on the table in front of them, and they might not be able to see the options themselves at the time, but if you put them down on the table in front of them, and they can pick and choose what they seem to be right for themselves.
And you said to me earlier that what you really wanted for both your daughters was that they would get into a sport and get into it quite seriously because of the discipline it teaches you and all the lessons as a growing human being, I guess. At what stage did you realise that Eleanor had quite a talent at cycling?
I think it was relatively early, because you know, I've watched bike riders since I was 12 years old myself, and there's certain riders that you look at and they just, there's just something about them when they sit on the bike and when they ride. It's almost like it's more natural being on two wheels than on their feet. And I think both Eleanor and Zoe sort of fall under that category. But I don't think it was really until this last year now, 2016, where really started to see the big potential, and when Eleanor decided that she wanted to start training hard, and she's come to me and said, "Dad, what can we do to improve and to go faster?"
And you said that you don't want to be a pushy parent. I mean, who does? But at the same time, I guess it's fair to say maybe you've been frustrated by Eleanor having to be held back to a certain extent, and you're trying to expand her racing a little bit, isn't that right?
Yeah, you know, we always want to sort of create the opportunities and create the ability to go and do and learn the sport in full. Looking across into the European races and stuff like that, the riders in this age category, in the 15, 16-year-old category, are getting to do a lot more road racing, open road races where there's longer circuits. There's more opportunities to create and build a bike race for themselves. So we're talking tactically, you know, having the patience to wait and using the hills, using crosswinds, using everything else. Whereas as good as the closed circuit facilities are that we have in the UK, they have a tendency to lend themselves more to a slightly more negative form of racing, because there isn't that opportunity to go for a longer hill, or, you know, there's this 2-3 kilometre dead straight road with crosswind on it where you can put it in the gutter and really sort of create something within the bike race. So I feel there's something that we need more of in the UK, and you know, if we can't, then we've got to go abroad and start looking for that, because I believe that they're being held back a bit.
And one thing you're doing as well, Eleanor, is racing against the boys a little bit. That's the route that Emily Didrikson, the world champion, took as well. What difference do you find racing against boys on the continent compared to the girls-only races here?
It's much harder and faster, because they seem to attack more and almost make the race a little bit more exciting at points, rather than leaving it to like a fast 10K at the end. They throughout the race will just constantly make it hard, but it brings you on a lot because you have to be able to stay with them, otherwise you don't end up going anywhere.
You mentioned you've got great expertise in your family, obviously. I mean, your mum and your dad both race at a very high level. What are their strengths in terms of the advice they can offer? Is it training? Is it tactics? You know, do they have different bits of expertise that they can share with you?
Yeah, they're both different advice they give me. Obviously, from women's racing, mum knows how that works, and she can give me advice about that, how late to leave it, when I can attack, all advice about the circuits, whereas dad can give me better advice for like European races and how to make the racing hard, how to attack properly and at certain points. But they both just support me through school and schoolwork. Anything I really want to do, they're there to support me.
Does your dad's coaching, does that involve showing you old videos of Paris-Roubaix?
Sometimes.
So we heard there from good friends of yours, Steve, the Backsteads, Magnus and Eleanor. It must be nice hearing them again.
Small community in Wales. We all know each other.
A story that you'll know well. But, you know, we obviously know Magnus Backstead, who is a former rider and now regularly heard on Eurosport as a co-commentator as well. And clearly very involved in his daughter's career. She's a huge talent, and her mother was a very good rider as well.
Yeah, it seemed a bit of an inevitability that she would end up in cycling. Magnus said that...
Well, she had to give it a go, didn't she?
Yeah, well, you might as well if you're going to have a shot at anything and follow your gene pool. But quite in contrast, really, to Abby Mae Parkinson I spoke to. She's just signed for Drops this year. She was with Cervetto Futon. She rode Ronda van Drenthe at the weekend. Did not finish, unfortunately. As she pointed out, though, fewer than 40 riders did actually finish that race. Represented Team GB at the World Championships last year, and another big talent. Daughter of Lisa Brambani, as I mentioned earlier. And as I say, quite a contrast, because it seems that her mum isn't really all that involved in her career. Certainly
certainly doesn't sound like a pushy mother in any way whatsoever, and that Abby May kind of got into the sport of her own volition. But just refer back to what we were saying earlier about how the younger members of a sporting family are determined to beat their older, and what we were talking about, siblings. It was quite funny chatting to Abby May, because she says her big driving force is to be better than her mum. So she wants to do her time trials faster. She wants to win more titles than her, and that's her benchmark. So quite a nice thing to aim for, really. But it sounds like a very healthy relationship that they have. So I spoke to Abby May Parkinson. Here she is.
When I was young, I kind of started off doing swimming. Like, there was nothing to do with the bike until quite later on. I was a swimmer, and then my school was really into running, so I kind of got into a bit of cross-country, and I did some triathlon. And it wasn't until, I think I was maybe like a second year under 14, that from triathlon I kind of thought, oh, you know, I like doing the bike. And I kind of went along to, like, a bit of, like, a local club practice around Bradford, and bumped into Mark Barry, who both my parents kind of raced with, and he was coaching, so he kind of took me under his wing and helped me along, and he's big into the track, and I got brought along to Manchester Velodrome, and that's kind of where I got picked up with British Cycling, really. Well, from doing triathlons, really, I had, like, this pink mountain bike that I absolutely, like, I don't know how I managed to ride around. And we used to, when we were young, like, we used to just, like, ride around a playing field. And I can remember, like, the earliest memory of doing this triathlon, I was did my swim, and then I got out the pool, and you put on, like, your tri belt with your number, and you put your trainers on and get on, and I'd finish this triathlon. And I tried so hard, I was like, I was sick, and I looked down and my trainers were on the wrong feet because I'd got all my belt up. And that's kind of like my first kind of like sporting memory, really. Just like this pink mountain bike and this epic triathlon that I don't know how I managed to love doing that, but it was important that I was doing sports. I was always a really sporty child, and I mean, when I was really young, like, I'd even be going to swimming before school, and they'd be getting up at sort of like 4:30 to take me swimming early morning before school. So, like, I do think that they loved me being in sport, and it was kind of like what I enjoyed. I know that they wouldn't have wanted me to do something that I didn't like. And I mean, like, when they finished cycling, they had nothing to do with the sport until I then took it back up again. There's quite a lot of cyclists whose kid rides now, like Jesse Walker, Chris Walker, and Ollie Wood and Alistair Wood. They all used to ride with us, and Lizzie Holden, who's my teammate now, Rob Holden, her dad, who my mum and dad used to race with. So they're kind of like interacting with all their old friends from cycling, and it's like super different for them. But especially my dad, he's got really, really back into the sport. And when I was a junior, he helped with some of the team perspectives. So, like, he's definitely fallen back in love with the sport. But when my mum was riding, there wasn't much support for women cycling, especially in the UK. And my mum started riding a bike quite late, as well as retiring quite early. So she moved to America to kind of get the support she needs. And it's great now that I can have all the support being in Europe, and Europe is kind of like the place where we can sort of live and everything. And British Cycling has developed so much for women's cycle, for the women as well, so that it's a big difference to when my mum was riding. I definitely do want to be better than my mum. Like, we are competitive in that way. And like, even when I was sort of like, you know, a few years ago when I was doing the 10-mile time trials, she had like a list on a medal of the times that she won like competitions with them on 10-mile time trial, and it'll be sort of like, oh, I'm nearly beating you, and then like I beat her and I'd be like, oh yeah, I'm so much better than you. But no, it is really, really good. And like especially when I did the Giro last year, sort of like just knowing that like you've got so much support around you. And my mum used to race with a woman called Maria Blower, who really helped me at the Giro actually, because she'd done the women's Tour de France back when she was riding. So it was really good that I sort of had so much support and tips from when they were riding. She is like a really sort of tough Yorkshire girl, is my mum, and sort of like to never give up is the main thing, you know, like she would never DNF a race, you know, without giving her all, and it was like the last sort of thing that you could do. So like just never really give up, never, like I would never be a soft rider, I'm quite like hard, and I think I've definitely learnt that from my mum. I'd probably say like my mum is kind of tougher on me mentally, but that's kind of, I feel you need that to progress, and my dad's sort of like the soft one who will say it's all okay. So it is like a nice kind of a balance.
Quite nice to hear from Abby May there talking about the parents who, former riders themselves, who are now meeting up again through their kids at races. I like to think of them with their flasks of tea and their sandwiches wrapped in tin foil by the side of the road, with the little deck chairs. It's probably nothing like that, but it's quite nice to hear that.
Well, on that note, Orla, I spoke at the Women's Tour last year to Chris Walker, whose daughter, Jessie Walker, who was a teammate of Abby May Parkinson's last year in Italy, has retired from the sport, sadly, although she's still involved. Maybe she'll return to racing at some point. But I spoke to him. He was a top rider. His wife was also a top rider. So another cycling family. And Chris Walker had an interesting perspective, and his son is a bike rider as well. He had an interesting perspective on just how far women's cycling had come since his day. Jessie was saying that she'd obviously been cycling all her life, mountain biking, her and her brother, and that when they both got into road cycling, you were cock-a-hoop, delighted.
Yeah, it was a difficult thing because you don't want to feel, you know, like you're being a pushy parent. So we never really did push them into it. You know, we just let them enjoy the mountain biking, and, you know, they were doing it from, you know, kids. So, but like I say, never really pushed them into it. And they decided, you know, both of them decided they wanted to do it off their own bikes, which is the way it needed to be, really.
How do you feel now with your daughter, Jessie, having, you know, the opportunity that perhaps didn't exist 20, 30 years ago for a young female rider to be a professional and to ride in races like this?
Oh, it's absolutely brilliant. We were looking at some pictures the other day when my wife used to race for Great Britain, but she used to have to race as a junior with us in the same race as us, and they used to start them in front, and there'd be probably two or three riders. And then since then, when we got back into it, we had a small team with youths and juniors, and there was like 60 riders under 16, 60 girls, you know, lining up. So it's absolutely amazing. And yesterday to see it on TV and the amount of support, but and the racing as well. The racing was, you know, brilliant racing, really. You could tell, you know, if you'd done it before, you could tell how grippy the race was. So the racing hard as well, which is brilliant.
So that's a massive change, isn't it? You know, just maybe even not even the last 20, 30 years, but in the last decade.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So, you see the team setups here. It could be a men's professional race in town. Or you've got the same setup with the team buses, all the cars. It's unbelievable.
So that was Chris Walker himself, a former top rider and the father of Jessie Walker. Cycling is a real family sport, isn't it? It does tend to be passed down through the generations. I wonder why that is. It's particularly in places like Belgium, you know, the their whole cycling family dynasties there, the Plankerts and others?
I think it's because it's such a family-friendly sport to do anyway. It's the kind of thing that even if you're not a professional cyclist, if you're into riding in any way whatsoever, you'll want to go out with your kids, won't you? It's a lovely way to spend time with them. I mean, I know I'd love my daughter to come out riding with me. So I think as well, whenever the kids see that there is a potential career in that, which most kids when they're out riding their bikes would just think it's for fun, if you see that there might be a career path in that, then you're maybe more likely to go into it as well. But I think it probably comes from just it being quite a wholesome family activity at its very core.
You were mentioning another cycling family, Steve.
Yes, the Barkers. So who I do know.
Welsh.
Because they're
Welsh, aren't they? Welsh cyclists.
So, well, I know Eleanor. I don't know I don't know Megan. But
he doesn't
I
know mean, all the Welsh riders.
Absolutely.
We've established
but
that.
There's another fantastic sort of cycling family built around that South Wales hotspot. Megan, obviously, Eleanor, obviously, an Olympic champion from Rio. And I think Megan is on the GB Academy now, or certainly the Olympic Development Programme, not entirely sure. And I know sort of some great things expected of her, and I think Eleanor as well, who will just continue to, she's still very young and still continue to develop. I think she's got some goals on the road in terms of time trial, which would be exciting to see, as well as probably continuing through to Tokyo 2020.
The Barnes sisters, the Garner sisters, there's so many of them,
there's
aren't
loads
there?
Loads of them.
It's amazing.
Yeah. It's interesting though, isn't it, that going back to what Orla was saying, in terms of there seems to be like this family dynasty, and you sort of wonder why that is, and I guess it is because you see parents and siblings doing things and you aspire to do them, and that's how the sort of it almost propagates for the sport. Wouldn't it be great though if we were in a position where, because the superstars of the sport were so visible on television, that actually lots of young women and young girls actually were able to see the sport and say, I want to be like that. And that's how we then created the next generation of cyclists, rather than necessarily just having to be passed down from family to family.
I think that is starting to happen. And I seem to speak about it in every episode, but there is that balance to be had between momentum and patience. And I do think these days, right now, in the last couple of years certainly, we have seen, even if they are more track cyclists than road cyclists, and I'm talking very specifically about here in the UK, so apologies to international listeners, but Laura Trott is a household name. Vicky Pendleton is a household name. Lizzie Deignan, maybe to a lesser extent because she's road, but we are starting to see that, and that is going to happen a little bit more, I think. Dare we be optimistic and hopeful? Is that just
me? Come on, Steve.
I think you're right, but have you spotted that I'm a little impatient?
Anyway, Why not?
Let's leave it on that optimistic note this month, shall we? We'll be back next month. Not sure what we've got planned for that, but I think you're going to be going out to one of these inaugural women's... Are you going to Bastogne-Liège?
I'm not sure which one I'm going to go to yet, but I'm going to go to one of the Ardennes.
That'll be great. Looking forward to that. And we also this year will have as the cycling podcast, we produce 11 friend specials throughout the year. You can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. I think we've released, by the time this goes out, we might be on to our second friend special of the year. Lionel Burney's doing a series of podcasts from Flanders. And the one after that will be Matt Heyman talking through his win at 2016 Paris-Roubaix. You can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com for £10. But one of our friend specials this year will be on women's racing. It will be most likely a rider diary, a bit like the Joe Dombrowski diary that we did at the Giro last year. Details, not least the identity of the rider, will be confirmed very soon. And the race could be the Tour of California. Watch the space. Anyway, that's exciting. In the meantime, that's all for this month. So thank you very much, Orla.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for coming to join us, Steve.
Thanks very much, Richard.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.